As far as we know, in a man that age, only two things can cause a stroke. Violent anger or fear.
Well, in your country, I believe they call it a coffee break.
Hiroshima.
Well, hello, Jellyheads, and welcome to an exciting new episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. I'll add effects later, or not. You'll know. I am your host, Dave, with my friend and co-host...
Luke.
Ah, my captain.
Captain, my captain.
I should just start saying that. I should start introducing you as my captain.
My captain, yes, I am. Don't forget it, kids. I am your captain. Forever.
Oh, this is going to be a good episode. I can feel it.
Hopefully, because I'm having trouble remembering some things.
Yeah, I wonder why.
I don't know. Every time I fucking sit in that chair now, I fall asleep.
It's the chair.
It's like a chair with a curse on it,
except the curse is that it makes you fall asleep.
Yeah, it's like now I have to watch movies sitting at my computer or something because I'm just going to fall asleep.
You're just too relaxed, which sucks because it's like you should be relaxed.
Yeah, but I'm too relaxed.
Too relaxed.
Too relaxed. My body.
He just slipped right into a coma. He was too relaxed.
That's like great for like a Lazy Boy commercial or something. You're all gathered around a bed and you got this guy in a coma laying there and he's got this like happy face on him and like the person's asking the doctor and it's like, what happened to him? It's like, well, he got so relaxed he fell into a coma.
It's the darkest Lazy Boy commercial. I like it. I like where your head's at.
Cut, print.
Anyways, we're here tonight to talk about not one but two monster movies of the 1950s. And we're going to start off with The Monster That Challenged the World.
An upheaval of nature tears loose a creature out of the nightmare of time. Spawned by an earthquake on the bed of the ocean, a reptilian earth-shaking beast of the sea. The monster that challenged the world.
My tank.
What's wrong?
Blake's tank is caught in the undergrowth.
My God! What happened?
Oh my God, his body. He died right in front of me. I couldn't help him.
I better go back. Talk sense. What's down there?
I don't know. I never saw anything like it before.
It's the size of a dinosaur and 10 times more terrifying, hurling the horrors of the unknown at every living thing.
What's funny about doing a double feature is that a lot of these movies were packaged as a double feature. It's something that doesn't happen today, and I think it would be interesting if it did happen today. Like, these movies, upon release, were packaged together. So for the price of one ticket, you saw two movies, but they were lower budget movies. Can you imagine if they did that today? Do you think that would work?
They usually only do it as like a special event. Where, like, a new movie's coming out, so they're going to show all the ones leading up to it. You'll do, like, the Star Wars marathon and watch all the Star Wars movies leading up to the next one.
Well, this was on initial release. Two movies were paired together.
Right. Other than the drive-in, I don't know if you get that to work anymore. Because people are just not going to want to spend that time.
Yeah, that's so weird. People are just like, we don't have the time for that.
I mean, that's something I love about... drive-ins. I pay less than I do at the theater.
And you see three movies.
I see two movies.
Well, you usually don't stay up long enough to watch the third one, do you?
Oh, well, the drive-ins I've gone to never have a third one.
Oh, the drive-in around here plays three movies, holy but it's cow. Like the third movie, you're like, it's usually a rated R movie. It's usually a kid's movie, a PG-13 movie, and an R-rated movie, or two PG-13 movies or something like that.
Yeah, that's at the one like I go to a lot. It's like they'll have the family-friendly one first and then the higher-rated one after, which is usually the one everybody's actually there for.
Yeah. Usually at the drive-in around here, it's like the first crowd that leaves after the first movie was only there with their kids. And most people are there for the second feature, which is like a superhero movie or something, right?
Yeah.
And then the third feature is probably like a horror movie or something. So most of the crowd leaves after the second movie.
Okay. When you move out here, man, we'll have to hit them all at the drive-in.
Absolutely. I mean, this show is called No U-Turns at the Drive-In.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We actually do have to go to a drive-in and see a movie at some point to legitimize the name of our show.
I saw a great double feature at the Malta Drive-In. It was Jaws and Jurassic Park.
That is a good pairing.
Very good.
You know, that's a funny thing they found out about double features back in the day, is that if they paired two different types of movies, they couldn't sell as many tickets as if they paired two like movies.
Yeah. If you came for one, you might be more interested in seeing the other as well.
As opposed to being like, here's something like this and here's something like that. Here, two different types of movies. People would rather watch two movies that were very much like each other.
Yeah.
Right back to back. And I feel like whether it's at a drive-in or you're hosting a marathon at your home or something like that, that makes sense. It's just one of those things where it's like, you've just seen something like this. Wouldn't you rather watch something different? Nope. More of the same. Give me more. Pile more of that stuff on my plate. I like the first serving.
So.
Yeah.
Why are we exploring this as a double feature?
Well, these movies, we just reviewed them.
Sort of.
I hate the word reviewed. We just discussed the movie Them. And that really perfected the giant monster movie formula. And every movie that came after that was really copying that formula.
Them was way better than I was anticipating.
I hadn't seen it since I was a kid when we rewatched Ditto. It. And I am now totally in love with that movie. Like, I'm obsessed with that movie now. I might get an Italian poster of that movie because it's the Italian poster of the movie is a really awesome poster. Like, I'm just like, I want this. it was just one of those things where I saw that and I'm like, I must have this.
But it is like the definitive bug movie.
It was following this trend that happened where they re-released King Kong and that was successful. And they were like, geez, we should make a new movie that's like King Kong. And they released The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which is like a bare bones basic sort of thing where it's like, it's sort of loosely formed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's in a primordial state. It hadn't matured yet. The fruit was not ripe.
Matured.
And then you get Them, which is, they made Them because of the success of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and Them hit the formula perfectly. Now, you can say that movie doesn't have the best pace in some spots, but it always picks back up again. You know, it maybe has a slow moment here, but then it picks back up.
Yep.
And I would put Them against any other giant monster movie of the 1950s with the exception of Godzilla.
Oh, you can't be Godzilla.
Yeah, it's Godzilla. Yeah. And even then, it holds up well against Godzilla. We'll have to get to Godzilla later. We might do a double feature there of Godzilla, of the American version and the Japanese version.
Oh, the differences between the cuts, right.
Oh, yeah. They're significantly different.
Context is quite changed.
The context changes a lot. They're both good, though. I'm tempted to show you the American version first.
What is that?
For decades, that's all you had access to in this country. So that's the way most people experienced it, was to see the American version. And then, in the early 2000s, they finally released it on home video in the United States, the Japanese version. And people were able to go, wow, this... This is what this movie was really like. This is what the intent was. And it works better that way because I don't think you can do the reverse because the Japanese cut is better, is the better version of the movie. So you can't go from the better version to the lesser version. You have to go in the opposite direction.
Okay.
And part of what makes it better is seeing the contrast from the American version, I feel. So without seeing the American version, you don't understand why the Japanese version is better. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Anyways, what movie were we here to discuss?
The creature that challenged the world.
The monster that challenged the world.
I'm sorry.
This title is terrible.
Also known as the Jagged Edge.
Well, not also known as, but like in the development phase, which is what's happened with, we've noticed this a couple times with the movies, is that the in development titles are better than the actual title that they come out with, that the movie is released under, because this had two different in development titles. The first was The Jagged Edge, which...
That sounds cool.
It sounds really cool. Sounds more like a 70s film or a late 60s film to me. Yeah. Or like a 40s like film noir, like The Jagged Edge. Yeah.
The Jagged Edge with a Johnny Cop.
Johnny Cop. Tell me more. What's the story, The Jagged Edge with Johnny Cop?
He's a renegade detective who doesn't play by the rules, hunting down the trench coat mafia.
The trench coat mafia. There's a specific mafia for trench coats.
Mm-hmm.
Are they men who wear trench coats, or are they living trench coats?
Yes.
Who have formed a mafia?
Yes.
I want to see this movie, Lucas.
Coming out 2022.
The Jagged Edge, the trench coat mafia story with Johnny Cop.
Johnny Cop.
But this movie, Dave, get back to it.
Yeah, because we don't know what we're doing, or this is not scripted.
Well, I don't know. It's been like 2 weeks since we watched it, and...
Yeah, well, the second title, would just to wrap that up, was The Kraken.
That's not terrible either.
I think that would have been a much better title. I think if this movie's sort of lost to obscurity, and it's a solid monster movie of its time, but I think one of the reasons that it's lost to obscurity is that title is so benign. It's just so meaningless. The Monster That Challenged the World. It sounds awful. It sounds like the worst movie ever. It sounds like the beginning of the end, which is the worst movie ever.
The poster also looks like a lady getting it on with a water bear.
That's true. You can't tell what the monster is by looking at the poster, and then you read reading the description, you read giant mollusks attack California, and you're like, oh, I'm going to skip this one.
Yeah, when you said like giant snails attack a harbor, and I'm like thinking, did they just get like big sea snails and like had them squish over a model? Like, that's what I was picturing. Not
exactly
huge caterpillar beasts.
Yeah, because it's a weird design, this monster.
Yeah.
But it's also an awesome design.
Yeah, it looked pretty cool.
You don't expect a puppet, really.
No, but it's a puppet.
It even eats through a door.
This is one of the cooler monsters of a 1950s movie because it's not stock footage of an animal superimposed over the screen to make it look like it's the size of a city, which is the worst effect ever.
What they do with whatever the Prey Mantis giant movie is.
The Deadly Mantis, The Beginning of the End, Tarantula, that's just a spider that they took footage of a spider and they pasted it over a city. You know, it looks awful. The absolute worst version of this we've already discussed, which is Teenagers from Outer Space with the lobster. God, that is the worst effect
ever. Pretty bad,
ever.
Yeah.
But this is a solid monster movie. But you actually need someone to introduce it to you and say, no, it's worth watching. To actually sit down and enjoy it, you know? Because the poster and the title and the premise, if you hear it summarized, all sounds awful.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do any justice. I mean, it's not the best thing in the world, but it's not. It's a solid monster flick. It's still puppetry, like we said. It's still like a physical.
Yeah, there's something there that the actors can interact with, much like them.
Things happen.
They had giant puppets of these ants. But unlike them, this isn't just like a giant sea slug that they've made. Like, it looks like giant. This does not look like a slug. This is a weird monster. This is like this alien thing. And it kind of looks a little like it does belong in an alien movie. Not like the prime creature, but like maybe like a background creature in an alien movie or something.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Something on the trophy wall of the Predator's room, you know? That's what this looks like. It's weird. It's different. And it's what makes the movie work, is that when you see the monster, that payoff is satisfying. And the reason we're talking about this and the Black Scorpion, which is the other movie, is that they're both descendants of them. And they both show how what had been the formula that was perfected in them had become routine. And they're both movies from 1957. They're from the same year. We're going to reveal our bias ahead of time. The Monster That Challenged the World is the better movie.
Yeah. Black Scorpion's got some pretty good claymation.
Yes, the stop motion in that was done by Willis O'Brien, the same animator who did King Kong, and you can tell.
Some weird fight footage between a squishy, multi-limbed worm and scorpions. Lots of
part of it kind of feels like lost footage from King Kong.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that would be the best way to describe it. But the problem is they don't stick with that. They use other effects, which are terrible, including a puppet, which is just a derpy-looking thing.
That they use for, like, the poster, right?
Yeah, and then they do the superimposed shadow monster over, say, like we said, it's the worst.
But it's not the worst.
But no, I would hold these up as the two better descendants of them.
Why?
Because every other one just uses stock footage. These two examples, by my criteria of what we're going to cover in this, is that it has to be a made monster, meaning it has to be claymation or puppet. It can't just be stock footage cut and pasted into there. Someone had to make a monster for us to consider discussing it on this show. That was my criteria. And that cut out a whole ton of movies. It's like if you advertise movies having giant dinosaurs fighting in it, and I go to the movie and I see two lizards with fins glued to their backs fighting each other, I'm disappointed. That's not cool. That immediately makes your movie suck. I'll take a bad claymation or bad puppet as long as somebody put in the gosh dang effort to make something.
You silly wasker webs.
There's a dinosaur movie where the puppets are so bad that the guys in the costumes could not move the dinosaur, so they'd just be like sitting there in the desert. And there's like behind the scenes footage of these guys just falling over in their dinosaur costumes. I would rather watch that. Honest to God, I would rather watch that than these movies where they just cut and pasted. Except maybe Tarantula. I don't know. I haven't revisited Tarantula in a while. Clint Eastwood bombs the monster in a jet, so I'm like,
Tarantula.
Have to check out Tarantula. But now that we've talked at length about movies we're not going to talk about, The Monster That Challenged the World!
The world!
The plot of this movie is that you have a military base. They're just, like, testing stuff. They got guys jumping out, parachuting, and falling down to this lake. And they're like, okay, let's go pick up the guy. And they go to pick him up, and he's not there. It's like, huh, what happened? And then all of a sudden, they see something in the water, and it totally freaks them out. Cut back to the base. They're like, where are those guys? Those guys should have been back by now. We gotta go check them out. They go out there, and the guy's dead.
Died of fright.
I think in the original parachuter is like missing, and it's like they pull up another guy who's just like a skeleton. You know, he's just like all dried out. All the moisture is like sucked out of his body.
Although I thought that was like the parachutist.
Oh yeah, I think that was the parachute guy.
Parachute guy.
Parachute guy.
Parachute guy.
You don't have a name. You're not credited.
Loser.
You're just a body.
Loser.
So yeah, now they know that something's going on, but they don't know what. And this kind of plays up that what's happening investigating issue that we saw in them done so well. It doesn't hit the same level of that eeriness that them does, but it's still there and it's still good. It still works. Here our protagonist is this, I don't know what you call him. He's the new, he's the new guy in charge over there at the base. And everyone's sort of like sizing him up, saying, this is the new guy, huh? Let's see how he runs things. And he's played by Tim Holt, an actor who primarily did Westerns, and you can tell that here. Like, he's just playing this character as if it's a Western.
Yeah.
And he's a cowboy. And not like the gritty Westerns of like the spaghetti Western era. This is like old-fashioned sort of straight-laced cowboy guy, right?
Right.
But Tim Holt is not a bad actor. He came out of a semi-retirement to do this movie.
Why?
I don't know. Money. They paid him.
I needed it. Don't blame me.
Some extra money, easy work. But they shot this movie in 16 days, Lucas. So,
that when I read that, I was like, what? How? What?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a movie that was shot in like...
No.
A little over 2 weeks.
I would expect like a Roger Corman flick.
Right, considering that, it's like, this is pretty impressive, isn't it? But they also, they're part of the system, you know. They had a machine to go out there and say, all right, we're making this movie, this is our hours, let's shoot this thing, let's get done. Puppet was probably made ahead of time, it was just like, get in there and shoot the scenes, right?
Well, they had to have been like a really tight plan to get through the whole thing that quick.
Probably they did. They probably shot all the scenes in one location at the same time.
They did a lot of things around the Salton Sea.
Yep, which they claimed was natural.
It was not. Naturally made at the it was beginning. An irrigation accident. It's still there, even though like half the things dried up, the Salton Sea's still there. But the town that started popping up is totally abandoned. Still roads with names on Google Earth that have no homes on them, or abandoned homes.
So probably right... where this was being shot.
It was probably like at like the peak of that era, because it was like the 50s that it happened, and it was like, oh great, a lake just out of nowhere, it's this fresh saltwater lake too, and everybody started purchasing property and a town started sprouting up, and then nope. But it was probably around that time when like things were hopping, and it was like, yeah, let's get movie in here, and then maybe they got some tax breaks or something, I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah.
This movie was shot in what is now a ghost town. That's interesting to think about. How many times does that happen?
I don't know. When there's a ghost town, you shoot the ghost town.
No, it's like, I'm sure somebody's gone to a ghost town and shot a movie, but to shoot a movie in a town, and then that town just dies. Years later, you know, it becomes a ghost town. It's like, oh, okay.
Ooh. Ooh.
Now, like I was saying, Tim Holt was... not a bad actor. He actually starred in an Orson Welles directed movie, The Magnificent Ambersons, and that was Welles's follow-up to Citizen Kane, and he was the star. He was the central character of it. But that wasn't his best performance, though. His best performance was in John Huston's The Treasure of Sierra Madre, where he's alongside Humphrey Bogart and Walter Huston out there going crazy over gold in the desert, you know. And that's a great performance, you know. So this is a guy who could act. And you can tell that he's not uncharismatic, but he's just kind of there in this film.
I'm trying to get the two movies straight in my head, too. This is also the one with the random side characters, right?
The random, very weird side characters.
That just do things.
Like when they're doing their investigation, trying to figure out what happened to these guys out on that boat, they're talking to the coroner. And it's a very typical scene for this kind of movie. It's like, you know, oh, what's the diagnosis there, doctor? And it's like, well, it looks like mumbo jumbo gobbledygook. I see, mumble jumbo gobbledygook. Well, that piques my interest. And then that scene ends, but the scene in the movie keeps going. And it's like, oh, hey, wait a minute. Because the doctor actually says, oh, hey, wait a minute, which blew my mind. I'm like, it's like this scene hits the point that it should end, and then a character on screen actually says, oh, hey, wait a minute, one more thing.
One more thing. I keep sandwiches in this body freezer. You want some?
And the main characters are totally weirded out by this. They're actually like, no, thanks, no. It's like, you sure they're cold? It's like, you keep them. Why is the scene there? How did this not end up on the editing room floor? It's like this gag that they just did on set that just, they needed to pad time for the movie, so they left it in. It's so weird.
Or the director just, he was so attached to it, he didn't want to get rid of it.
Yeah, but there's literally no reason for that to be there. It's like, who thought it up? Why did they shoot it? How did it end up in the movie? It's the, all these things had to happen where it just sort of like, there it is. Oh, hey, wait a minute. One more thing. Would you like a sandwich?
You like a sandwich? I promise there's nothing on it.
That was Columbo's line where he'd just be leaving the scene and talking to a suspect and he'd go, oh, and one more thing. You know, and then he'd drop the like bomb on him where it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, you can't talk your way out of this. So I couldn't help thinking of Columbo there. Wish Evan was on. He does a good Columbo impression. So anyways, that was weird. And then later in the film, you have, again, what should be a typical scene for this type of movie. Now, I can sort of understand it because of it's following the precedent set by them, but it still seems odd here. And that's the girl who goes out swimming with her boyfriend and gets caught by the monster, and then you cut the grieving mother, right?
Right.
Going, oh no, my daughter, right?
But it's like preceded by a scene where the mother and daughter like are arguing about her going out.
But it's not like a flippant argument. It's actually like it came from a more dramatic movie? Was this like the writer? Just because this was done by like a first-time screenwriter. This was like their first thing that got made.
Okay, so maybe there was like they had a bunch of ideas. They got to that scene, they're like, oh, and like this just won't be a side character. Like there'll be pathos to this scene where the daughter wants independence, but the mother is overprotective. But then it turns out the mother was right.
Yeah, it's weird because instead of the girl being like, oh, mom, leave me alone. You're not hip. The girl's like very serious. She's like, mother, I understand, but you have to let me make my own decisions. It's like, that's way too serious for the movie that we're watching about giant sea slugs attacking California.
And then she's not a main character. She's dispatched.
Yeah, she has the Jaws scene. She goes out into the water and she's like looking around and all of a sudden something pulls her down underneath. Oh, it's the Jaws scene. And that's not the only parallel with later movies that this has. This also has the Shining scene where the monster's breaking through the door. It's literally like, here's Johnny, you know. It's like its face is like poking through the splintered door. As the woman is protecting her daughter inside this closet, you know, that they're shut up into.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost exactly the Shining scene, you know. Mother and child, monster breaking through the door.
Except a giant sea slug and not...
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
I know it's hard to tell the difference.
Oof.
Ooh, yeah. That was not even deserved. I just took that shot for no reason. Because
what
I could.
What did he do to you, Dave?
He just made great movies that I enjoy. But then also, the ending where they fight the giant puppet monster in the lab, and they're trying to protect the little girl, it feels a little bit like Aliens. You know what I mean? The boss fight in Aliens with the queen.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit, just a little bit like that. And here's the thing. I know that none of these scenes were direct inspirations for the later movies. Jaws, Shining, or Aliens. Probably the people who made those never saw this movie. Okay, Spielberg might have seen this movie.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's actually probably pretty likely. But, man, now I'm thinking of the one the one that may actually have been a direct inspiration was the Jaws scene.
Yeah, although even the Jaws scene was, just done out of necessity?
Yeah, it wasn't what was scripted. They came up with it because they couldn't get the giant shark to work.
And it worked better.
Totally. Especially with, when John Williams got his hands on it, put that score to it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best scores in movie history, if you ask me, in my opinion. And then following up the weirdness of this scene is when the mother finds out that her daughter was eaten by the monster. Like, again, it's a B movie. All that's really required of you is to go like, oh, no. They're there now. You know? That's all that's required. But this lady is like freaking out and she says a line like, oh, I could tear my eyes out for the things I said to you. It's like, whoa, screenwriter.
This is a different movie.
Yeah.
We got stuck in here.
Yeah. Whoa, we just got invaded by like a soap opera or something. The screenwriter just didn't know the tone. To get the right tone, it feels like. And then the third weird character who shows up is the weirdest. He's this guy who's like the town archivist, who has this collection of stuff that he's acquired whenever some older member of the town dies. And he has all this town history that he's collected. And he's very weird. And he talks like this. And he's his behavior is just, like, creepy. And people kind of ignore him in scenes, and he like sticks around and they kind of just turn around and look at him awkwardly like he's still there. Like,
why are you still here?
Again, was this like, was some of this scripted, or was just somebody was like, throw this guy in the movie? see, just let the other actors react in character.
Well, if you're saying it's his like first feature film, I can see him, the writer just like, he doesn't really know how exactly to tell the story he wants, and he's just like, he's got these ideas for these other things that maybe he should have left out for other films, and he's just like, I gotta get all my ideas in on this one.
But this character is like somewhat out of Twin Peaks. It's like the log lady. <you know? laughs> His significant contribution to the plot is he finds a map of like an old well system which the monsters are using to get around. But like, they go and talk to him, and he's constantly talking about how he's petitioning to get more money for his collection because of for its historical value, but the town won't give him more money. They won't sign, no one will sign his petition. It's just kind of like sad. But seriously, it's like a character from Twin Peaks showed up in this old 50s B movie, and you're just like, what the why is he here? And again, the only explanation is that young screenwriter just threw these things in there. But it makes the film more memorable because you're like, this is the one that has that weirdo in it. Again, if there was a precedent for this with Them, where they interviewed the crazy guy in the hospital bed who is just like,
but that context of that makes sense.
Yeah, they make it make sense there. The whole structure of that movie is like an episode of Law and Order. It's like they're just going through interviews with people to find more evidence to find the monster, you know, the suspect, you know. I'm so impressed with the movie Them. Cuff that ant. Cuff that antennae.
Cuff that lant.
But yeah, they have the final showdown. By the way, again, weird thing, and was it the screenwriting or was it something that happened on set? Where the final fight with the monster happens in the lab, and the entire time, our hero is like spraying him with a fire extinguisher, spraying the monster with a fire extinguisher, and there's an axe on the wall behind him.
You see him run towards the axe, and then he picks the fire extinguisher under the axe.
That you don't see! You can't see the fire extinguisher. You see an axe on the wall, and he runs back there and picks up a fire extinguisher off the sidewall that you weren't looking at because you were looking at the axe. It's right there. Why doesn't he pick up the axe?
And he just starts spraying the monster, and it works.
But there's
but
there's an axe on the wall.
There is an axe on the wall, and it is a fleshy beast. Do you think it would? That's what I would have grabbed.
Yeah, and the entire time you're waiting, all right, he's going to use this fire extinguisher, and when that's used up, he's going to grab the axe. And when the fire extinguisher is used up, he pulls some piece of, like, lab equipment that's, like, feeding gas to some of the equipment. He pulls out this tube and just starts spraying the monster with that. And it's just like, what are you doing? There's an axe! We have established this, the visual language of film, which you are ignoring here! You've set this up and you're not paying it off. And it doesn't. It doesn't pay it off. He keeps spraying this monster with stuff from the lab and throwing beakers of acid at it. And then the MPs show up and shoot the thing to death. And it's just like, there was an axe the entire time. I'm still mad about this. It's 2 weeks later. I'm still... I can't let go.
Oh. It's okay, Dave. It's okay. It died.
Okay, Lucas, there's one more thing that I have to ask you.
Mm.
There's a little girl in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And she does stupid things that put the characters in more danger.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, cinder block or not?
Now, why would you question whether or not she was a cinder block?
Because the kid is not presented as being dumb. It's not like an aw shucks kid. It's like, aw shucks, ah, you know.
But like, does she serve any purpose to the story other than just being an obstacle creator?
That's it. It's like a cinder block, as we define it, is a kid in a movie whose sole purpose is to do dumb things to create unnecessarily more peril, or necessarily for the plot to have, you know, something exciting happen, you know. Mm-hmm. But in the context of the movie, it's like this kid doing stupid things caused more problems. And that's the only reason the kid was in the movie. Cinderblock.
Well, the second movie had one too. Scorpion?
Oh, yes. Unquestionably a cinderblock there.
He hit along in that that thing, and he let out a giant mite that chased him and caused people have to ignore the scorpions. And
yeah, they were stuck down there longer, and maybe they could have gotten out easier.
Yeah.
But they had to save this kid.
Why did he get in there?
He kept saying, I went down to help, which makes no sense. That's an even worse offense.
That's like the big, that's what they always say. That's what they always say.
I just wanted to help.
Yeah, it's like they wanted to be where the action is. And the filmmakers wanted to put a kid in peril to create artificially enhanced stakes. Whereas, like, the kid in this, there are rabbits in the lab, and she likes to go over, I want to see the rabbits, Mommy. Which makes me think of Mice and Men, but that's a whole other issue.
I love the rabbits.
Now pet them and hold them and squeeze them.
George.
But, yeah, she likes, of course, a kid's going to be drawn to, like, if you have a bunch of rabbits in your lab and this kid is just stuck hanging out in this lab with no other children to play with, of course the kid's going to be drawn to rabbits in the lab. So that makes sense. And then they have an egg.
Most terrifying news giant of all.
On the
nightfall, monstrous animals crawl out of crater of volcano.
Which is the worst effect in the movie because it's just a plastic bag underwater.
Yeah, it is.
And it's like, it's an egg. It's like, really? I thought it was the parachute.
A creature named the Black Scorpion by panic-stricken people
with money and the worms.
Entire
yeah.
Population
they didn't have
for
any
deliverance.
Other special effects.
They only had 16 days to
Cowboys
shoot this
came
thing.
Upon one dead
oh, man, that's so bad. That seems unreal.
Yeah, the director promised he was going to make the egg the day before.
Isn't that something just like a director to say, hey, I'll have this thing ready to go, and
nations
then he shows up
confer,
and
as news
he's like, you know what, I was busy
this
last night, and
the
egg I was putting together, well, it didn't really hold
the
together the way I thought it would, and it's kind of just a mess in my bathroom now. So what ideas have you got in the photographers, actors, locators, maybe post. So yeah, that happened. But yeah, they had the A. egg in the lab, and to keep it from hatching, they were keeping the lab cold. And the little girl's in there, and she's like, oh, it's too cold for the rabbits, so I'm going to turn up the temperature to make the rabbits more comfortable. So it's dumb, and it just creates unnecessarily more peril, and actually it kills all the rabbits, too. Did you notice that? It eats all the
produced
rabbits.
Produced on a scale never achieved before.
Dumb girl.
Science fiction picture.
Dumb little girl.
Thousands in the cast.
You cinder block. They feel about just being just a dumb little brick of concrete.
But it makes sense in kid logic. Logic. I don't fault that. I kind of fault the parents for just being, just go play in the lab with the giant monster egg. That's fine. That's not going to get you killed in a monster movie.
Yeah.
While definitely not the worst offender of the cinder block syndrome, it's still a cinder block.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, let's get around to discussing the Black Scorpion. This movie is not so good.
Yeah. That is,
That's pretty much the only assessment we can come up with for the totality of the film. It's not so good. What's great about it, as we've previously mentioned, is the special effects by Willis O'Brien, creator of King Kong, securing his place in movie Hall of Fame history. He created fucking King Kong. That is astonishing. And no one could do anything close to that. For 20 years, seriously, the guy was great, inspired Ray Harryhausen. He hired Ray Harryhausen to work for him. He gave us Ray Harryhausen, who went on to create, you know, dream visions come to flesh, you know?
Dream made flesh.
That's what Harryhausen did. Like, these guys totally deserve their place in movie history. That being said, they weren't in control of the movies that they made, so some of the movies that they worked on are shit. And this is one of those cases. I wanted to watch this movie because I remembered seeing it as a little kid, much like them. And I remember being thrilled by it as a little kid. Like, I specifically remembered the scene where they went down into the cave, and it's like, oh, underneath this, in this cave, right underneath this volcano, which I'm not sure entirely how that works. But, yeah, this cave right by this volcano had these overgrown insects that had just been thriving down there for who knows how long. And they're just giant scorpions and giant worms. And it's like, that really captured my imagination as a kid, that they just, like, go down there and it's just like this whole other world. You know, it's basically the Lost World or Journey to the Center of the Earth kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a scene in this, but that really captured my imagination. I remembered it like being really exciting. and then I sat down to watch it with you, and the main characters got on screen, and it was just talking heads on and on and on. And lots of exposition. This guy's pointing at a map and saying, the last scorpion was seen over here. Then there was a scorpion seen over here. We have a picture of the scorpion. Here's the picture of the scorpion.
It seems to be a lot of these movies, these sci-fi movies, just guys in a room going, military or scientists pointing at a map and expositing about things.
If you want to know whether a movie from the science fiction 50s era is worth watching, it's like up on YouTube or something. Just like scroll through it. And if you just see a bunch of guys in suits sitting around in a table, skip the movie.
I always want to like make a movie where like the people sitting around the table is exciting.
You'd make The Social Network.
Social Network? Nah, I mean, I was thinking more like 12 Angry Men, but there's a monster movie going on the outside.
Well, you would make the last Japanese Godzilla movie then.
Oh, yeah, that was that was what that was, wasn't it?
Yep, that's what that was.
Really, really zany boardroom scenes.
I don't hate that movie. It's not my favorite Godzilla movie, of course, but it's
a
like,
weird one.
It's a weird one. It does stand out.
It's a really
out.
Weird one.
I like the weirdness, though. I'm pro
it's
the weirdness.
It's interesting, yeah.
And like I said, that those like boardroom scenes, those guys sitting around, I've heard somebody discuss that who is more familiar with like Japanese culture, and those scenes are very satirical. Like this entire Godzilla...
I could tell.
I mean, we can understand that satirizing the old 50s movies.
Yes, but I could also tell that it was definitely poking a lot at like Japanese politics and stuff. So
exactly, which is a context I think is lost on a lot of people who view it and just think that those scenes are boring. It's like, no, you kind of have to get it. You kind of actually do have to pay attention, and you see those scenes are actually weirder and funnier than you think they are at face value.
Like the one Japanese actress they had that could speak English is like, I'm going to be president.
Yeah, that would make sense.
The American actors they had, they were real bad. But
oh, dude, you should watch other Godzilla movies with me that have American actors.
I was just like, yeah, that's par for the course. But it doesn't matter to them because it's, you know, the audience, a lot of them aren't going to speak English. So, you know, that's like hearing somebody speak Japanese in an American movie. It's like you're going to tell that they're speaking it all that badly.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes.
Yeah.
Of course, sometimes that's good. It's like the character in Return of the Jedi who's actually like speaking Korean. And they show that movie in Korean and they're like, we understand what he's saying! Or wasn't, you said the guy who now hosts The Daily Show?
He knew the language that was being used for the Jawas.
The Jawa language, yes.
And they were like having like a deep philosophical conversation about what it means to be a man or something.
How did George Lucas have access to, like, how did that come about? Like, I want to hear the story behind how that ended up in the film.
You make the language for me.
Like, did George Lucas even know what the Jawas were saying?
I don't know.
No, now all we know is like, zucchini!
Utini!
Yeah, I know it's Utini. Yeah. Utini! But every time I see zucchini, I go, zucchini! So that's our show, folks.
Until next time.
To put it simply, I really appreciate some of the special effects work that was done in the stop motion of the Black Scorpion, but I do not want to continue to talk about the movie just to disparage it. It's just a boring film.
I fell asleep.
With a ridiculous ending.
Yeah, just skip to the ending. Gonna watch it.
They're trying to shoot the spear into the neck of the biggest scorpion and electrocute it, and the first time misses, but they threw the switch and they reel it in, and the guy grabs the hook to reload it, and it's still electrified, so he just electrocutes himself and dies.
Why?
Just so our protagonist, who, like, that was a guy that they just brought in at the last minute. He's like, I'm the guy who shoots the thing. And they're like, all right, you go. But since he dies, our protagonist, who's been sitting around this film the entire time, he has to make the shot.
Then why have the other guy at all?
Exactly. It's just like unnecessarily padding. You didn't need to have that first shot miss. It doesn't add anything. Just have the protagonist be the one who's taking the shot. Yeah. They just randomly killed a character for no good reason. Although, I will say this. If you're going to watch The Black Scorpion, MST3K did it.
Oh, that's good. So watch that one. Yeah, watch that one.
That probably helps pick up the slow moments, and then you still get to see the cool special effects. All right, so there.
There we go.
That's a hell of a thing.
That was the thing. Thanks, audience, for listening to us here at No U-Turns of the Drive-In. We've been your hosts, Luke and
Dave.
If you enjoyed what you listened to, may I suggest you go to our website to find this and other podcasts at psychogenfish.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever podcast app you so desire. And you got anything to say about these films, please leave them in the comments. Really to help the show.
Have a good one.
Keep it psycho.
This feels like Rick and Morty's trailer, you know, where they're flipping through channels from other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Which are, those are some of my favorite jokes in the entire Rick and Morty.
Two brothers who are brothers.
Yeah, it feels like he just improvised those.
Oh, he
and
did.
They animated.
Yeah, he just got drunk and improvised in front of a mic.
That's crazy how that show is made. I wish more shows had like a, a wilder or more offbeat sensibility about how they go about making the show. Like how weird late night TV got when the writer's strike was on.
It got real weird.
Yeah, but it was great. It was the best time to watch. It really was.
They were crossing over with each other all the time because it was like, I don't know what to do. Just come on my show and wreak havoc.
Yeah, it was. It was exciting because you didn't know what was going to happen. They didn't know what was going to happen, you know? It was just turn on the cameras and let's put this out there. I like that. It didn't always gel, and you couldn't make it last forever. But, you know, after a while, it would get so tiresome. But for a brief moment, that was thrilling.